But what can we say about the soul after neuroscience? Is there any point or need for the soul after the incredible discoveries of neuroscience, especially in the 20th and now in the beginning of the 21st century? These are good questions, but we first need to know why they should be our questions. Why should I concern myself with the brain in neuroscience or with the metaphysics of the soul in the first place? This too is a great question, but it's not the one we should start with. Or rather, we should start with it because it's among the more articulate questions that we've often inherited, but we should set it aside for the moment and begin again somewhere else. Why? Because our apparent articulateness with this kind of question about souls and brains often conceals from our view our inarticulateness with respect to both the bigger picture and a number of related crucial issues. The first of which is our inarticulateness in understanding the varieties of rival conceptions of the soul. Not just one conception of the soul, our ability to articulate multiple, rival, incompatible conceptions of the soul. The second is our inarticulateness in appreciating the real, but measured and quite controversial, significance for human life brought about by the major historical shifts in our understanding of the organs for cognition, emotion, desire, consciousness, and so forth. Said otherwise, we've become so used to talking about souls that we've forgotten why we had any use for them in the first place. The soul is, among other factors, so I'll be arguing, an explanatory factor. It helps us understand and explain certain aspects of human life, perhaps even some of the most fundamental aspects of our lives. But if we've forgotten what these fundamental aspects of human life are, we cannot recall what it is about human existence that generated explanations that appeal to talk of souls, then we cannot understand the original question, why do we need souls after the discoveries of neuroscience? Similarly, we've become so familiar with talking about the brain in our everyday language that we've forgotten how little human life has changed, even in view of the long history of discoveries in neuroscience and its precursor scientific disciplines. There's no denying the real significance and important changes for our lives provided by the medical discoveries related to neuroscience. But it's no less important to point out the obvious. One can be not just completely ignorant of all neuroscience, one can in fact hold completely false views about the brain or parts of the nervous system, and in fact, there's an extraordinary proportion of all contemporary neuroscientists who hold false views about the brain insofar as their working hypotheses, many of which will be proven false in the future by their present views that are incompatible with those. So neuroscientists are today putting forward hypotheses. They disagree with their colleagues down the hall, and one of them is going to be right or they're both going to be wrong. So even extraordinarily competent neuroscientists hold today what will turn out to be false views about the brain. So despite all of that, we can all still learn, contemplate, and even contribute to the vast wisdom of human understanding and all of our efforts to follow the injunction that was written at Delphi long ago, know thyself. So knowledge of the brain is not a prerequisite for having one's life enhanced or transformed or challenged by the great works of human wisdom. And it probably rarely occurs to us when we read many of the great authors what their views of the brain were, or that they had radically incompatible or different views about the brain. When we read Homer, the books of Exodus, Psalms, Kings, Isaiah, the Gospel of John, Sophocles, Plato, Aristotle, Marcus Aurelius, Augustine, Arabian Nights, Dante, Shakespeare, Dickens, Nietzsche, it doesn't occur to us that they have radically different views about our physiology or our biology or about the brain, but we can look to all of them and find rival and incompatible views about the soul and about what the purpose of human life is. But we can recognize what all of them have to say as wisdom or thoughts or reflections about human beings. So the unshakable core about which orbits important and influential rival and incompatible views about souls and about different theories of the brain, what unshakable core we find is the human person and our existential wonder about what is the purpose, meaning, or ultimate good of human life. This shall be our starting point, and this is where we must begin if we're to understand correctly why there's been both so much wisdom and even more careless chatter concerned with the relevance of souls and brains to explaining the nature of human existence. What's always in the foreground in all of these authors throughout history is the human person. But the soul and neuroscience only provide background explanations of human life, even if absolutely crucial, fundamental background explanations. So let us begin again, but now with the question of the human person before and then after neuroscience and the soul. But even this is a tricky question. Is it philosophical? Is it a theological question? Perhaps it's an ethical, legal, historical, or sociological or anthropological question? It can indeed be any one of them. But it too can too quickly be regarded as being only a theoretical question. So before it becomes a theoretical question, we need to ask, where does a theoretical conception of the human person come from? We need to begin once again, now with a non-theoretical encounter with the human person before we turn to any theorizing about them. So we need to appreciate the messy quotidian and the complexity of human persons before we begin to engage in the more abstract, theoretically articulated tasks of scientific, philosophical, or maybe theological investigations in the human person. So what is a human person in a non-theoretical mode? Well, just look around. That's what human persons are. Human persons today in our society, they're beings that are born, they grow up, they sleep, they wake up, they say good morning to loved ones, they might marmalade a toast, they get frustrated whenever someone finishes the milk without replacing it, they might wash dishes, navigate their way to work, stop off at the post office or the bank on the way home. These are things that human persons do. They raise families, they join and participate in various local practices and communities, or attend lectures, they can get sick or injured, and at some time, they will all pass away. But you already know that, and you know a whole lot more as well. Your own repository of human experiences with other humans is immense. And if you have expanded it through discipline and detailed studies of the humanities or the human sciences, it's even larger. However, what's so often lacking in us all is the ability to articulate the nature of the kinds of oscillating transitions that occur from our everyday practices and the wealth of fallible common sense to the basic stands we might hold dear on the meaning of our own existence, and finally connecting all of this up with the ever-expanding and self-correcting horizons of various kinds of theoretical inquiry. What we lack is a clear picture or an account of how to articulate the interconnections amongst our existential worldviews, our disagreements about our practices, and our disagreements within our theoretical inquiries. How do we bring these all together into a balance? What we need first is something like an image or an icon of the human or anthropos prior to any theoretical logos of the anthropos, of the human. Any truthful logos of the anthropos, that is, any anthropology, whether it be philosophical or scientific, presupposes and must stay in step with our common sense icons or images of being human. Our logos or theoretical account of human beings must proceed from a thick image of the everyday experiences and practices of human persons. This is something also the cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz really emphasized, the importance of thick concepts in doing cultural anthropology. Only after we've transitioned from an image of the human person to a logos of the human person can we then finally turn to a logos of the soul and the brain. And finally, then after all of these inquiries, we can arrive at a reevaluation of our initial image and logos of the human person. So this is what I meant earlier by saying our question must be, what can we articulate about the human person before and then after neuroscience and the soul? We start from a common sense view of what we are as human beings. We then arrive at a theoretical account of human persons. And we can move from there to a theoretical account of reflection on the soul and theoretical reflection on neuroscience. And then finally, to bring that back to bear on our ordinary common sense and theoretical understanding of a human person as a unity. All of us are already, to some degree or another, more or less articulate with some image or picture of what we are as human beings. Wittgenstein argued that many of us are held captive to a picture of ourselves, a false Cartesian picture, which Wittgenstein argued deeply misrepresents what we are. It is a picture that encourages a misleading image of the soul, the mind, and of their connection to the brain. I agree with Wittgenstein, and I want to add to his charge the need for us to become multilingual and not just monolingual in our ability to articulate images and accounts of ourselves as humans. Becoming more articulate with multiple images and accounts of us as humans helps us to see what is mistaken in false images of humans, so as to help us arrive at a more adequate, more truthful image and logos of humans. It also prepares us to know how to situate and place the sort of declarations we find in the media about various discoveries in neuroscience or various discoveries about neuroscience related to the soul. So this is where theoretical distinctions finally can help us. The theoretical distinctions we employ should help us discipline and make more articulate our self-understanding of our everyday experiences and our practices. Think of these theoretical distinctions as a kind of conceptual therapy or heuristics. They help us guide and revise or rethink the boundaries and the grooves in which we understand ourselves and others. But as a kind of conceptual therapy, as Wittgenstein said, it takes more than one, you know, attempt sitting on the couch. You have to go through this quite a few times more. So by the end of this, you know, we'll all probably need a few more sessions. With these caveats in mind, let us take a first step into some basic theoretical distinctions, some conceptual therapy about human persons. Alasdair MacIntyre and Charles Taylor share a common concern for starting with the common sense before theory, and so starting with the logos, and so the presentation of this sort of theoretical account of humans that I shall present owes a lot to these Aristotelian philosophers. The human person, we can say, is a dependent, developing, rational animal. Humans are continuously dependent on other humans for enabling, developing, and then exercising the suite of capacities common to us all as rational animals. These include capacities for embodied exploration, social attachment, emotion, social interaction, linguistic competencies, practical reasoning, intentional acting, and various expansions of these capacities into moral, religious, aesthetic, political, and theoretical activities. We find then here a difference between our powers and capacities that we acquire through human development and our ability to exercise these powers. We distinguish between the toddler who can learn to speak English from the adult that has acquired a mastery of English and can exercise this capacity at will. This capacity to be able to speak English is distinct from the exercise of this capacity by actually speaking English. These distinctions obviously generalize in similar ways to our capacities for seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, imagining, remembering, reasoning, understanding, voluntarily acting, and so forth. But they also apply analogously to a more general distinction between our personhood and our personality. Each of us, as developing dependent rational animals, are human persons. Our personhood consists in our stable ontological identity as biological organisms. It's the ontological identity, our metaphysical identity, our being, as a developing rational animal. Our personhood enables our developing, dynamic, and sometimes unstable personality. So personhood and personality. It's in virtue of our abiding personhood that we remain the same individual human being, the same human person, from conception to death. It's our personhood as rational animals that enables our maturation and our variations in our biology, our psychology, our social contexts, and our culturally informed personality. Our personality can and does change in a host of different ways throughout our lives, from birth through childhood, adolescence, through young adulthood, into middle age, and on into our dotage. Our personality changes as a result of a complexity of factors, from our biology, our social contexts, at work, home, in a community, as citizens, and also due to our psychological maturity, our education, our wishes, our desires, our interests, sense of humor, practical reasoning, and the various virtues and vices we form over our lives. So one's personality is comprised of the range of developing capacities and dispositions, temperaments, activities, and conscious behaviors that are exhibited by human beings throughout their life. The importance of this distinction between our relatively stable personhood, as distinct from the dynamics of our developing personality, helps us to avoid reducing our personal identity to conscious states or our lifestyle, our temperament, or the ability to remember or recall events from one's past. So it's based on distinctions like this between personhood and personality that we can say, for instance, dementia might radically alter someone's personality, but it does not thereby take away their personhood. They remain the same human person, no matter how much this neurodegenerative disorder might rob them of their personality. So we can add to this distinction between personhood and personality of humans a well-known theoretical distinction between personal-level attributes and sub-personal-level attributes. Since this talk of persons is getting overly complicated, I think it'll be easier if I instead employ an equivalent distinction between psychological and sub-psychological attributes. But I'm using an equivalent to those who are familiar with this other distinction, which originally Dan Dennett made in, I think, 1969, and Jennifer Hornsby and John McDowell have articulated further variations of it. So my construal of this distinction between psychological and sub-psychological attributes is not to be confused with the mental-physical dichotomy. Rather, it's defined in opposition to positions of Cartesian materialists and Cartesian dualists who endorse the distinction between private observable mental attributes and public observable physical attributes. So this mental-physical dichotomy, which I'm rejecting, it's central to the articulate but I think false picture which Wittgenstein has argued held us captive and which we too, I think, following Wittgenstein, should reject. Drawing on Wittgenstein, contemporary Aristotelians like myself hold that both psychological and sub-psychological attributes are largely observable, they're embodied, and are at least hylomorphically physical. I'll explain what hylomorphic means later on. So my conscious intentional action of drinking coffee or a bottle of water, this is a psychological attribute, and it's no less observable than the coffee mug or the expression of enjoyment or satisfaction on my face. Any full explanation of human behavior on the view that I'm articulating will require us to integrate the distinct but compatible explanations provided by our psychological capacities and the multitude of formally organized sub-psychological capacities that our embodied psychological powers are constituted from. All right, there's at least 2 points where you have to kind of hold on because it's going to get a bit dense with some of the theoretical distinctions I'll make, but I'll let you know when you can wake up again once I've come to the end. Psychological attributes include the familiar common sense items we just mentioned before with regard to personhood and personality. These were capacities, dispositions, and conscious activities for sensation, perception, imagination and memory, practical reasoning, and intentional action. These are psychological attributes. What do I mean by sub-psychological attributes, especially given the fact that I'm rejecting this mental-physical dichotomy? All of our embodied psychological abilities and our conscious embodied activities are constituted from the formal organization of various sub-psychological capacities, especially well-known physiological systems. So sub-psychological capacities are physiological systems largely, like the nervous, muscular, motor, cardiovascular, respiratory, and endocrine, and other biological systems. So whenever I consciously see some object, I'm exercising my psychological power of vision, which thereby simultaneously enlists certain sub-psychological capacities and mechanisms like the eyes, extraocular muscles, the optic nerve, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and the visual cortex and the occipital lobe of my brain. Whenever I deploy my power of memory to recall some event from my life, I simultaneously, by exercising memory, thereby also enlist the coordinated activation of the sub-psychological capacities of the medial temporal lobe in my brain, and perhaps, in particular, certain neuroassemblies in the hippocampus. Similarly, when I travel to London by train, I deploy a host of psychological abilities for perceiving, remembering, practical reasoning, and intentionally acting in order to navigate my way from home in Cambridge to the train station to London and wherever I need to go from King's Cross. By so intentionally acting, I thereby simultaneously deploy a host of sub-psychological capacities like my muscular, nervous, endocrine, and cardiovascular systems, which themselves enlist mechanisms for action potentials, the Krebs cycle, protein synthesis, and so forth. This Aristotelian construal of the distinction between psychological and subpsychological attributes preserves the unity and the integration of both kinds of explanations without confusing their differences. On this account, it's the rational animal, the human being, that is the proper subject of psychological attributes of seeing, imagining, reasoning, believing, desiring, intentionally acting. It's not the brain or any parts of the nervous system that are the proper subjects of these psychological attributes. So it's a mistake to attribute perceiving, believing, desiring, or any other psychological or personal level attributes to the brain. For the brain on this account and its parts cannot be the subjects of these psychological attributes. Rather, the brain can only be the subject of the formally organized subpsychological attributes and powers that constitute and enable these aforementioned embodied psychological attributes. The distinctions about the human person I've introduced so far are themselves contentious. The distinctions are contentious, and even my Thomist Aristotelian construal of them is at odds with well-known and more dominating Cartesian materialist construals of them. I'll continue to presume the cogency of these Aristotelian accounts because I do not have time to defend them tonight. But if I were to do so, my arguments would draw upon a range of resources, starting with a series of reflections on ordinary experience and showing how alternative construals, especially Cartesian, dualist, and materialist construals, how they all, I think, introduce a host of different kinds of absurdities. These basic Aristotelian theoretical distinctions concerning human persons help us maintain the unity of the human person. A unity we experience as a matter of common sense, and we can explain at the level of theory, using a lot of the sort of distinctions I just used. And we can do so without drawing upon what I take to be our confused and misleading forms of articulation of ourselves provided by Cartesian materialists and Cartesian dualists. As Alcidor MacIntyre has noted, the unity of the human being is neither the unity of a mind nor that of a body, but the unity of a single being with various mental, moral, aesthetic, and physical powers, including powers of self-awareness and self-referential thought directed towards the achievement of rationally ordered ends. That's the view I always want to have in view. And if my theory has gone away from that or gone astray, there's something I think problematic not with the view about the human being, but something wrong with my theory about a human being. Finally, we can turn now to the explanatory role of souls and what they provide for our image and logos of the human person. Earlier I said souls are in the explanatory background to the role of the human person that's in the foreground. So what it is that we need to explain about human persons that generated all these different rival views about souls? What in particular explains the unity of activities and the unity of living being? For Aristotelians, this is first and foremost a general question for all living beings, not just humans. So there's a tendency today to immediately go to the human being, focus on them, think that there's something unique about the mind, and that's where we start talking about the soul. For Aristotelians, they start with living beings in general, and that's where they first want to start talking about soul, and we'll eventually get to these questions about the mind. So, at this point, it'd be helpful to begin with a rough taxonomy of theories about the soul to see how we're going to develop along the way. We're going to start with the biological concept of the soul, in particular the Aristotelian one, and then we're going to move on to a consciousness concept of the soul, which is often associated with Descartes, a view that Aristotelians reject. And then finally, we're going to come to a spiritual, eschatological, or what you might call a religious concept of the soul. So we're going to start with we're going to cover three different views about the soul, but we're only going to get to what I would consider to be properly religious views about the soul at the end. The first two concepts are both broadly philosophical, and one could hold them independently of any religious or spiritual convictions or commitments. So first, the biological concept of soul. Following Aristotle, he writes, and Aristotle dies in 322 BC, Aristotle thinks that all living organisms are animated by an immanent, actualizing, organizing, formal principle they call a psuche. In Latin, it was translated as anima, and we often in English translate it as soul, which can be a bit misleading given the variety of different conceptions of soul we've inherited. Historically, Aristotelians held all living organisms can be distinguished into vegetative and animal life, but contemporary Aristotelians have adequately shown this concept can be applied to various post-1970s taxonomies of the three domains of archaea, bacteria, and eukaryota. David Oderberg has a detailed treatment of these kind of things in his monograph, Real Essentialism, if you're interested. Aristotelians maintain that the soul is the form of the organic body. It actualizes, transforms, and sustains the organization of a material body as an organic living or animated body. Aristotelians locate this biological concept of soul within the broader metaphysics of matter and form, which is called hylomorphism, from the Greek words hyle for matter and morphe for form. So I'll be talking about hylomorphism a lot, and this is just the doctrine of matter and form. It's important to stress that for Aristotelians, even though form is real, and so souls are real, souls and form are not one kind of thing, with material bodies being another extrinsic kind of thing. The reason material body exists as the organized unit it is explained by Aristotelians by its form. So form and matter are not two separate extrinsic things or substances. Rather, they're principles of a composite single substance. So just as one cannot separate the table from the wood, so also one cannot separate the form from the matter it actualizes, organizes, and unifies. For Aristotelians, physical things are single substances that are constituted from the unity of matter that's actualized by form. What does soul add to this picture? Soul is just a distinct kind of form, namely the kind of form that explains what differentiates physical living things from non-living physical things. Both physical things have forms, but the animating form of the organic body of a living physical thing is called its soul, or animating form. So, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip, but I had a brief section distinguishing this account from vitalism. Vitalism is another kind of biological concept of soul, one that really developed a lot in the 18th and 19th centuries and faded out at the beginning of the 20th century. I don't have time to go over why, but they're very different kinds of views about soul, vitalism, from the Aristotelian view about form as soul. Let's go on to our second conception of soul. This is going to begin with a Cartesian account of this, a Cartesian construal of the idea of the soul as a conscious mind. And this account of soul is incompatible with the Aristotelian conception of soul I just articulated. This is because it understands the soul to be some extrinsic entity or substance separate from the inanimate physical world. Historically, Descartes denied that living beings like animals, including the body of humans, are animated by any kind of soul. So already that's very different than the Aristotelian picture I presented so far. The soul was identified with the private, unobservable conscious mind, which somehow interacted with the body through some special organ. For Descartes, it was the pineal gland in the brain. For the 17th century Oxford professor of medicine, Thomas Willis, it was the corpus callosum, the set of tissues and fibers that are right in the center of the brain that connect the two hemispheres. And then later, and more recently, in the 20th century, many of the great pioneers in neuroscience, like Arthur Sherrington, Wilder Penfield, and Sir John Eccles, all of them articulated their own versions of Cartesian interactionism between the mind, ego, or self, and what Penfield called the highest brain mechanism, and what Eccles called the liaison brain. So contemporary Cartesian materialists might well reject the substance and property dualism these philosophers and 20th century neuroscientists, but they're still enchanted and defend the same image of the human being that these individuals defend, which divvies us up into conscious material mind that somehow interacts with or is identical with the brain. The later Wittgenstein provided a veritable arsenal of insightful arguments to disarm and undermine this misleading Cartesian picture that still holds captive contemporary materialist philosophers and neuroscientists today. For the full picture of this kind of argument, you could look to Peter Hacker and Maxwell Bennett's Philosophical Foundations of Neuroscience for a very detailed, extended treatment of this kind of claim. Despite their protests that they reject Cartesian substance dualism, these materialist philosophers and neuroscientists continue to articulate their inquiries, run their experiments, and interpret their results by employing the same conceptual distinctions as Descartes. Aristotelians actually anticipated Wittgenstein in providing resources for criticizing and articulating alternative control of the conscious or psychological conception of the soul. So I started with this conscious account of the soul, and now I'm going to show how the Aristotelians also appreciate the role of consciousness and psychology for understanding the soul, but it's going to be wed to their already biological concept of the soul. For Aristotelians, some living organisms, namely animals, have a range of psychological powers in addition to their vegetative powers for growth, nutrition, and reproduction. These psychological powers enable animals to consciously perceive, explore, engage, and move about their environment. For animals, the soul is an animating form that grounds both these sentient psychological powers, the ones I mentioned before, as well as the basic vegetative powers common to all living organisms. These psychological and biological powers are understood according to a hylomorphic schema, matter and form. They understand these powers to be hylomorphic attributes of a hylomorphic substance. So, as Aristotle notes, the power of vision is the form of the eye, just as the sentient soul is the form of the organic body of an animal substance. Consequently, unlike the Cartesian view of the soul as a conscious mind, the Aristotelian construal of the psychological soul rejects the idea that there's any hidden mind or brain in humans or other animals that's the subject of consciousness or psychological attributes, like perceptions, memories, beliefs, and desires. For Aristotelians, it's the animal, the living organism, that's the subject of its conscious psychological operations, not the subpsychological systems of the brain or some inner private mind. To get more contentious, Aristotelians like Thomas Aquinas and Albert the Great maintain that in addition to the range of embodied psychological powers that we share with other animals, humans as rational animals also possess a few noetic or intellectual capacities that are not shared by any other animal on our planet, so far as we know. What are these powers? First, it's important to stress how expansive the suite of powers is that Aquinas and other medieval philosophers like Avicenna and Albert the Great attributed to non-human animals. Unlike Descartes, who held that non-human animals do not have minds, medieval and contemporary Aristotelians followed Aristotle and distinguished between embodied psychosomatic powers for the kind of conscious sentient operations that I've been talking about, and they distinguished these from immaterial intellectual powers for conscience, intelligent understanding, practical reasoning, intentional self-determination. Aristotelians attribute to non-human animals psychosomatic powers for conscious perception, somatic affections like bodily pains, imagination, memory, dreams, motivating passions, emotions, desires, estimating or registrative abilities, which are important for associative problem solving and purposeful psychological behavior. So from the 10th, 11th, 13th century, these are all philosophers that are attributing that range of abilities to non-human animals. This is an impressive ensemble of psychological powers, and no contemporary comparative psychologists or ethologists have provided grounds for ascribing psychological abilities to non-human animals like dogs, elephants, chimps, corvids, cephalopods, or cetaceans like dolphins that cannot escape being captured in some way by these Aristotelian suite of embodied powers. In other words, whatever the biggest story you're going to find by ethologists attributed to these other animals, those powers can all be understood and articulated in terms of these same powers that Albert the Great and Aquinas were conceptualized. We might want to make slightly different distinctions, we might want to articulate them differently, but the range of what they're attributing are essentially the same. So the grounds under which they made arguments for these would take us way beyond the time that I've left. And so just to want to summarize this section to bring it to a close, that Aquinas and others, what they do is they provide a wealth of intellectual resources for arguing that these rational powers and operations cannot be embodied like these other psychosomatic powers we share in common with many non-human animals. These are the powers for rationality, for types of intelligence, all of which are manifested in our various linguistic abilities. This is the most contentious point in the Aristotelian view, but I'm moving on. These rational or noetic powers, because what I want to really provide for you is a clear view of what exactly they would say today. How would a contemporary Thomist articulate their view? The contentious arguments that defend this is something to have for another conversation. So what is it about these powers? According to Aquinas and contemporary Thomists, these rational or noetic powers and operations, they transcend the confines and limitations of our embodied psychological powers. When we exercise these immaterial noetic powers, it's very important here, these intellectual powers, they don't interact directly on some parts of the brain, as was the case for Descartes in the pineal gland, Willis in the corpus callosum, Penfield's highest brain mechanism, or Eccles, brain liaisons, where the mind acts directly on these various different parts of the brain. Rather, for Thomas, whenever the human person exercises their immaterial intellectual powers, these powers actualize, formally coordinate, and they direct the coordinated actualization of our embodied psychological powers for perception, imagination, memory, emotion, registrations, and so forth. And so what Aquinas and Thomas argue is that the human soul that formally animates the body and which grounds these hylomorphically constituted embodied psychological attributes, that same soul also grounds these immaterial intellectual powers and activities. So it's one and the same soul that provides this explanatory account for the unity of an organic being, the human being, which is a unified biological, psychological, noetic, and social agent. Whenever the human person consciously, intelligently acts, what they do is they exercise in a unified and coordinated way their intellectual and psychosomatic psychological powers, and along with this, the host of sub-psychological powers in the biological systems that are hylomorphically constitute these psychosomatic powers. So crucially for them, it's not the eye that sees, the brain that believes, or the mind that is conscious, or the will that decides. Rather, it's the human person that it consciously sees, believes, makes decisions, and it does so only in virtue of its exercise of the unified coordinated operations of these diverse psychosomatic, noetic, and the subpsychological powers, including our brain. Sorry for the technical language of this last section, but it's impossible to articulate these distinct theoretical accounts of the human person without them. And just to be clear, what I have presented here is no more than a sketch of these different theoretical paradigms, and I've left out many details and arguments that their exponents would give for these rival positions on souls. So far, I've been dealing with philosophical conceptions of the soul that show how it's been employed to explain types of biological and psychological changes and activities. So in the foreground was these activities that we're all aware of and that we experience. What comes out in the background is the necessity of trying to draw on these explanations of souls to explain these different kinds of activities and operations. We come then to outside of philosophy, but sometimes argued to be complementary to philosophy, a range of spiritual or eschatological or religiously motivated views about the soul. And since I'm running out of time, I'll go over this very quickly. But these are views, which I'm sure you're all somewhat familiar with, different views, that appeal to religious revelation or religious experience or various other reasons, extra-philosophical reasons, extra-scientific reasons, for making claims that we have certain kind of soul. Now, Cartesians and Thomists argue that we already have independent philosophical grounds for saying the soul of rational beings is incorruptible and can survive death. But we might also think that there's religious or various experiences give us evidence for thinking that we should make the view or hold the view that our soul is immaterial or that it's spiritual or survives death, as well as various religious claims that our ultimate end is for our soul to be united with God or the good or with being, or that perhaps there's some Christian revelation about the beatific vision. And since this is, you know, Easter week, Easter reminds us about how Christians hold the view that ultimately our rational soul has to be resurrected or has to be united to a resurrected body. And so there are a range of further religious views that often get brought in to and combined with these philosophical views. But what it's important to draw attention to is that whatever these spiritual, eschatological, or religiously motivated views about the soul are, they're independent from these philosophical ones, but they're always going to be deploying some philosophical concepts, some theoretical concepts, to try to make more coherent and clear what they're maintaining in terms of these spiritual concepts. Okay. Noting the time, I'm going to very briskly, if it hasn't been briskly enough, present to you a potted history of the developments of neuroscience in the last 2,500 years. (Laughter) What's important to notice in this history is the way in which basic philosophical positions on the soul were articulated, often in connection with some particular empirical views about human anatomy, but that inheritors of these philosophical traditions, Aristotelian or Cartesian or Platonic, which I haven't talked about, had little difficulty introducing minor modifications to their philosophical theories of the soul or the mind based on sometimes rather significant shifts in the empirical understanding of the organs of the body. So this isn't true both of Aristotelians and Cartesians. And this is really going to be one of the main points of my talk, is that radical shifts in our understanding of the anatomy of the human being did not necessarily present radical challenges to the philosophical views that, even though they originated with certain kinds of empirical anatomical views. We begin with the Hippocratic writings of roughly the 5th and 4th centuries BC. In a short treatise called On the Sacred Disease, which was on epileptic seizures, the Hippocratic authors make the claim that our joys, delights, our laughter and sports, sorrows and griefs, despondency and lamentations, are how we acquire wisdom and knowledge, see and hear, all of these attributes are attributable to the brain. Less than a century later, in the 4th century BC, Aristotle would arrive at a different conclusion about the major organ for integrating our sensory and motor capacities. What's important to recognize is that Aristotle's still 400 years or so before they had made the distinction between blood vessels and our nerves. So the nervous system was not distinguished from a circulatory system. So for Aristotle, what he wanted to find is what biological organ is uniting all of the various different vessels that are coming from our muscles and our sensory organs and bringing them all together. And for him, that was pretty obvious, given the lack of differentiation between the nervous system and the circulatory system, is that they're all coming to the heart. So for Aristotle, the major organ that integrated our sensory abilities and our ability to make movements is the heart. And he argued against the Hippocratic view that it was the brain, that if you touch the brain, no one feels anything, which is in fact the case. I feel sorry for any soldiers or whoever he's operating on that he made these discoveries. But the point is that from Aristotle's point of view, the anatomy suggested that everything was coming through the heart and coming back out of the heart. And so that's why he located these higher level psychosomatic animal abilities for phantasia, for memory and sensory integration in the heart. 400 years later, the somewhat unorthodox Aristotelian philosopher Galen is drawing upon some of these discoveries between the differences now between the nerves and the heart, and quickly realized that the way in which all the that the nerves are themselves connected with the spinal cord and going up into the brain, and whereas Aristotle posited what he called vital pneuma, vital spirit, that was flowing through the blood and helping us to contract our muscles and sending various signals, Galen realized that we needed to posit a different kind of pneuma, a pneuma that was generated by the ventricles in the brain, to have a different fluid that would be flowing through the veins, sorry, the nerves, that would be important for the contraction of muscles and the sending of sensory signals up into to the brain. Now, what's important, the part of the brain that was relevant to Galen were the ventricles, the large cavities that we now know are full of cerebral spinal fluid. So Galen, still adopting a broadly Aristotelian view, just moves the main organ for the integration of our senses and our movements to the nervous system, sorry, to the ventricle system in the brain. But he saw no reason to abandon Aristotelian thought by this major shift of the one organ from the heart to the ventricles in the brain. And if anything, throughout history has been the most radical change in Aristotelian doctrine, it's this shift from the heart to the brain as the major organ. And it's not going to be the later shifts that occur in the 16th and 17th century from the ventricles to parts of the cortex of the brain, or more recent views about the neuron doctrine or the role of glial cells or other things like that in the nervous system. What followed upon Galen a century later is Nemesius, a bishop of Syria, who argued that the three Aristotelian powers of memory, imagination, and the common sense had to be located in the anterior ventricle, the medial ventricle, and the posterior ventricle. And this view proved to be very influential. And so the Muslim philosopher, Aristotelian philosopher Avicenna, he distinguished five internal senses, not just three, and he started subdividing the ventricles and locating them there. This view was received by Thomas Aquinas and Albert the Great in the 13th century, who continued to articulate the kind of Aristotelian view that I've been describing so far. And again, it's not the soul that's going to be located in the heart or the soul that's going to be located in the ventricles. The soul is the form of the whole body. It's just these psychosomatic powers or attributes. They're the ones that are being localized in these attributes. This view continued to be influential up into the Renaissance, including Leonardo da Vinci's early illustrations. So we see his early illustrations, which indicate it's unclear what they thought the anatomy of these ventricles were. A lot of these illustrations we have in manuscripts are just three circles going from the front to the back of the head. But what da Vinci did is he injected wax into the ventricles of cattle and discovered the horn shape of the lateral ventricles, and the shape is completely different than the three sort of circles. But yet he still maintains this localization of those various powers and those different ventricles. Then jumping ahead to the 17th century, with René Descartes, Descartes is going to change everything in so many ways. He's shifting to this other view about the soul that I mentioned, but Descartes's also going to move us from the ventricles to the substance of the brain, because he thinks the major interconnection now, not a power like these embodied powers, but rather the soul itself comes interconnecting at one point in the body. So the soul or the mind is no longer the form of the whole of the body. It's now just making an interface with one part of the body. And for Descartes, that's the pineal gland, which he mistakenly thought was in the ventricles. Nevertheless, it shifted attention from and away from the ventricles themselves, so that within less than 50 years, Thomas Willis at Oxford was able to start thinking more about the cortex, and in particular, he's thinking about the corpus callosum, and he's going to make that the major area where in which the mind is united with the brain. And then we can jump up into the 20th century. The role of understanding the way in which neurons can conduct electricity radically transformed various views about pneuma, both from the pneuma of Galen and Aristotle to the more mechanical corpusculars of Cartesianism, to understanding the way in which neurons conduct electricity. But finally, when we arrive at these major 20th century neuroscientists, Sherrington, Penfield, and Eccles, we still find largely Cartesian views that they're articulating and finding one little location in the brain or multiple locations in the brain that can be the liaisons between the brain and the mind. All right, sorry, I've gone over time, so I'll conclude. What's important to see here is that despite these radical shifts in the different explanations of the anatomy and the major organs that underline our psychological or mental powers, Aristotelians and Cartesians had little difficulty making minor modifications to their philosophical theories. The philosophical theories stand or fall on the philosophical arguments and the larger worldview that one's committed to, not on these sort of minor changes in the neuroscience. And so today, there are contemporary Aristotelians who have no problem trying to find ways to make their view empirically plausible with respect to contemporary cognitive neuroscience. There are Cartesian dualists, there are emergentists, there are a range of different kinds of physicalists or materialists in the philosophy of mind, and all of them have more or less plausible and implausible views about how they integrate the neuroscience with their philosophical theories of the mind or the soul or cognition. But the empirical plausibility of these views, both the Cartesian view and the Aristotelian view, that plausibility hasn't changed from the way in which the view itself was historically articulated. So what I want to conclude then is that the plausibility of these views depends largely on what we think about the philosophical arguments that are going to be made in defense of these views and their abilities to continue to provide us with plausible interpretations of both neuroscience, of genetics, of evolution, and of their ability to respond to various philosophical objections to the views themselves. And most importantly, the degree to which these theoretical accounts of the soul and the brain can be rendered coherent and cogent as explanations with respect to our everyday practices and our existential worldview. So finally, we arrive again at the end, now with the human person, but now considered after neuroscience and the soul. So thanks for your attention.